our discussion about the ever controversial and expansive issue of the Hatzimachira debate. So we had discussed that the premise, in order for there even to be a discussion about the Hatzimachira, seems to be that Hatzimachira is, that Shemitah itself is Drabanan. That if we're assuming that we're dealing with Yisuri Daraisa, so then we have a harder time, and it doesn't seem like any proponent of the Hatzimachira is basing his comments on that assumption. On the other side of the equation is not necessarily the case. Certainly many of the opponents may as well feel that Shemitah is Drabanan. Assuming that Shemitah is Drabanan certainly does not necessarily take you straight into Hatzimachira approval, but it seems to be a necessary step. So last week we talked about some of the broad considerations why that might be true. So now let's turn a little bit to the more specific consideration of just how does this whole idea work. So the major sugya, which appears a number of places in Shas, and I put this on the original Mamakoma sheet if you got a chance to see it, the most relevant sugya is the machlokas that appears throughout a couple of places in the Bible and the Yerushalmi, of yesh or ein, kinyan, lahafkia. It's kind of a fill in the blank sentence because to generalize it, you have to leave out a lot of words in the sentence. So either there is or there isn't, yesh or ein, kinyan la'akum lahafkia from blank, whatever the context of the sugya is. So whether it's a shumas and maestras or some other mitzvah tliya v'aretz, we have a debate. Is there such a thing as acquisition? Could it be that if the land is purchased by a non-Jew, that the Kedusha will cease? Now, it's important to note, as you consider this point, that when we posit that Shemitah is Drabanan, so there's an additional angle to consider, that it could be that Shemitah itself is Drabanan. We spoke about that last week. If we assume that it's contingent on the Jewish population being in Israel, either because of Yovos or because of Maestros. But there's also a question about the whole Kedushas Haaretz to begin with. That it could be that Kedushas Haaretz Yisrael is Manazeh, is Drabanan. That it could be that the Kedusha of Ezra was, this is also a machlokes from the Gemara elsewhere, that Kedusha of Ezra could have been Kitcha Lishaita below Kitcha Lasavavavav. It could be that he sanctified only for his own time during his Yishuv, and that following a Gullus from that, the Kedusha would not endure. So if that's the case, then Kedusha of Eretz Yisrael today is not applicable on a Torah level. And that might be a reason to see this whole concept as Rabban, not necessarily because of local Shemitah considerations, but because of broad Eretz Yisrael considerations, which would have an impact on many other halachic points. So if that's the case, so that affects the sugya, because when it comes to yesh kinyan hafkia, so the Gemara does mention, as kind of an exception, an area known as Surya. If you learned the Masechus Gittin, so you'd be familiar with Surya. So Surya is a part that's not subject to the same sanctity on the same level as Eretz Yisrael proper, and the Gemara conveys that it had the status of kibush yochid, that it was acquired in an individual sense by Jews, not as a national entity, and therefore, if that would be sold, so then it would lose its status of kedusha. And Rashi connects this to the idea that the Kedusha that comes from this Kibush Yafet is Drabanan. So that leads some to assume that if we're dealing with the Kedusha Drabanan, or if we're dealing with Din Drabanan, so then we could say that Yesh Kinyan Hafkia, that even if the majority position is in general Ein Kinyan Hafkia, that the acquisition would not make a difference. But if we're dealing with a status Drabanan, then there might be room to say that yesh kinyan hafkia. So if that's the case, so then the drabanan status factors in a couple of ways here. One, in that it makes it possible to conclude that non-Jewish acquisition makes a difference. And two, in that even if that's not your conclusion, but if we say that we're dealing with an Indra Rabbanan to begin with, and this issue is itself a machlokas, so then there is more room to be made. So here, in a more specific way, the Rabbanan status, if that's the case, plays a major role in perhaps coming to a conclusion that selling the land would give it the status of free from Shemitah regulations. So this, of course, again, continues to be a big machlokas, like everything in this issue. The Beis Yosef, and his Tshuvas Afkas Rocha, and others, of course, obviously Beis Yosef, very influential in the area of halacha. So Beis Yosef is of the opinion that the peros of land owned by non-Jews is not the subject of Kedusha. And this was a controversial point as well. So the Mabit and the Sunday Ma'arit, they argued on this. They debated this point, and that machlokas goes ad yom hazeh. That machlokas continues to rage. But there are many who follow the view of the Beis Yosef that the non-Jewish ownership should negate the status of Kedusha from the peros. Now, a couple of points must be made, and that doesn't mean that he's in favor, if you were to ask him, but communicate with Beis Yosef and ask him in favor of that from the Tira. So it doesn't necessarily follow. He's saying that land that happens to be owned by non-Jews would not be subject to Kedusha. He's not necessarily saying that one could sell it for that purpose. And it's very striking that if you look at the literature, so for example, as I mentioned, this machlokas goes on Adi Yom Hazeh, so there was a series of svarim written about 20 years ago. There was one sefer that was written to advocate against the position of Beis Yosef. I forgot, one of the sponsors called Minchas MS, another sefer, a similar title. And one sefer was written in response to that, explained that the position of Beis Yosef is correct. But if you look at the Haskamas on that sefer, so the Haskamas are certainly not assuming that that leads you to the Hetzer Mechira. And the proponents of the sefer, many of them are big opponents of the Hetzer Mechira. And one of them writes, particularly in the Haskamah to that Sefer, this is a wonderful Sefer, and learning the Sefer should give us the merit to see the time when Shemitah is Deraisa, and certainly we shouldn't have to rely on the Hetzer Mechira of Chas V'Shalom, which is totally awesome. So we certainly see a disconnect between the position of Beis Yosef and assuming that that has to take you to the Hetzer Mechira. So on the one hand, it's certainly a useful step for it, but there certainly is room for distinction. So that's itself a continuing debate, but if one follows the Beis Yosef's position, so then that does help to come to this conclusion. Now, it's also noteworthy that, again, to focus on this Dereis and Rabbanan distinction, so many of the advocates of the Hetzer Mechira, so they assume that the land has to be worked by non-Jews, that Jews should not do the avodas karka itself, which is essentially saying that Jews should not do any malachas daraisa. Right? This is part of the overlap between Shemitah and Shabbos. Not only do we have the imagery of one and seven and the like and the word Shabbos, but we also have a very similar terminology. We talk about the avos malachas and tolos malachas. In the case of Shemitah, it's really that the avos malachas Malachas Daraisa is different than Shabbos, but the terminology is similar. And some of the Malachas themselves are the same. We talk about Kisira and Zeria, so the same kinds of Malachas. Some of them that appear in Shabbos appear in Shemitah as well. So you find that there was this condition. For example, it was Tvochanan. Look at the picture. So you can imagine, as you look at that picture right now, that he's issuing that condition that the Jews should not do the Malacha themselves, and then he wrote that if it was impossible to find a way to have Jews not do the Malacha, then you have to ask the child again. You have to discuss if it was something that could be dealt with, if there was a way around that. That was the point that the Chazon Ish was very upset about, so it's not the biggest point he was upset about. We'll get to that either later or next week. But the Chazon Ish was one of the major proponents of the major opponents and the major enemies of the Hetzer Mechira, even more so than many of the opponents that we have today, because he took it to a different level, as we'll discuss. But one of his objections was, among his other objections, that here the premise is that they're not going to actually do the melacha themselves, and it ends up happening that they do the melacha themselves, and they say, well, what can we do? We don't have a choice, we're stuck. And he thought that was very inappropriate.
I mean, the whole point of selling it is not to do the melacha?
Well, it can't mean exactly that, because then what's the point of selling in the first place? And he said, if you were happy not to do the melacha, if you're happy not to have the melacha done, so then you don't have to sell the land. Right? The point is, it's part we discussed last week, that makes it a little bit trickier, or maybe significantly trickier than the Torah's chametz, that when we sell our chametz, so we're happy not to have anything to do with it. But when we sell our land for Shemitah, so we can't be satisfied with having nothing to do with it, because then there's no point. The whole point is to allow some profit to come from the land being worked. So the condition was not that the land shouldn't be worked, but that the Jews shouldn't work the land. It should be done through the labor of non-Jews. So the question is, why does that make a difference? Right? If you're trying to say that, well, we want to distinguish between Daraisas and Darabanas, but our whole opening premise here is that everything is Darabanas to begin with. If we weren't assuming Shemitah as Darabanas or Kedushas Arts as Darabanas, so then we wouldn't be discussing this whole matter. So why do we have to then distinguish again between Daraisas and Darabanas if the whole issue is Darabanas to begin with? So it seems, as Rav Zevin and others know, Rav Zevin in the Sefer Ha'alacha, Rav Zevin Svarim are always worth reading, but he has a very helpful discussion about this in the Sefer Ha'alacha. So as Rav Zevin suggests, that it could be that this attitude is because maybe the Beis Yosef's position only affects the produce, which is why I was careful to phrase that way before. That maybe it means that the results of the land are not subject to Kedusha Shias, but there's still no hechter to work the land itself. There's still an isser of the Avoda Sakarta. So therefore, to use the Beis Yosef towards the Hechter Mechira might mean that you could have non-Jews do this otherwise prohibited action of working the land, and then you could benefit from the payrus that came from that. But the avod itself, that would still be usher, and the Jew would not be able to do it himself. So perhaps that's why you found this condition. And again, whether or not the condition actually is observed, that's a different story, but perhaps it reflects that issue. So in any event, this question of Yesh Kinyan L'Hafkia is a major building block for the whole story. It's really, I guess, the major building block for the whole story. And that's a necessary step to get to any acceptance of the Hechter Mechira. Now, there are those who maintain that maybe nowadays situations have changed so much so that even this question, halachically, is different. That in general, so as we've said, so every 7 years you have a perpetual motion machine in Machlokes, you have the basis to reevaluate the whole story. So a lot of the reevaluation, I think we noted this last week, is really based on the Tzorach. That you could say that, well, maybe we needed it in the 1880s, but we don't necessarily need it in 2014. Or maybe the opposite. Maybe it wasn't so important in the 1880s when there wasn't a Jewish government there, but now that we have an entire economy that is dependent, a whole nation's economy that's dependent on such agriculture, so now it's a bigger deal. Just to give one simple example of how the changed context from now and from then can flip the issue one direction or the other. Because either way, either say that we should be more into it or we should be less into it. So here, there is an objection that was raised that maybe even affects just the halachic nature of the Shiloh. So Rav Gorin, who was, of course, one of the Ashkenazi chief rabbis of Medina in the 1980s, so he wrote in his sefer, a sefer called the Torah Samoedim, that he thinks that the Shaila has to be different. He has a basis with Santosis and Kedushin. He thinks that the basis has to be different now in the post-Medina era than it was before. And this question of Yesh Kinyan L'Hafkia, so maybe that made sense on one level when you didn't have a Jewish government. So the ownership of any given farm is because of the individual Jew who happens to own it. So the question could come, okay, so if he would sell his farm to a non-Jewish purchaser, so then maybe it would not have Kedusha Shvi'is. But now, we have two levels of Jewish ownership in any property in Israel. So you have possibly a Jewish individual who owns this land, and beyond that, you have the Jewish government that represents the ownership of the environment. So Rav Garvin thought that it's very difficult to say that selling the land really cancels out its Jewish parentage, its Jewish ownership, because even if the individual farmer sells it, but what about the fact that it's still part of the Jewish nation? And therefore, that would seem to impose Kedusha on it regardless. So that's just an interesting nakuda to note, that while the change time consideration often is more about the subjective factors, about need and about how appropriate it is, but on some level, some of these arguments maybe even go to the actual core fundamental halachic issues that are defining the whole question. So it also affects the next issue to consider, and that is many of the opponents were concerned about the seriousness of the sale. Is this a real sale? So we mentioned last week some broad considerations that are kind of inherent in the issue, that maybe the sale is not serious because we don't separate ourselves completely from the sold item during the time of the sale, nor would we accept a check for the whole item afterwards. Rav Herzog also pointed out, Rav Herzog, of course, was also a chief rabbi of Israel, so an earlier generation. So Rav Herzog noted also that it's a little bit less credible to believe that one Arab purchaser actually bought the whole land of Israel. When it comes to chametz, okay, so you can believe that the individual who purchases the bread in your house, okay, he actually has purchased it. This is one of the reasons, for example, many rabbis in the New York area who go to Arab Willig, Arab Pesach, to sell chametz in Riverdale. So Arab Willig sells his chametz to a real estate agent who is a businessman, and many reasons why he prefers that arrangement, but among them is that it's more of a solid kind of transaction if you assume the person knows how to deal with land and is a businessman of means. So you can believe that he's actually, at least theoretically, purchasing the chametz, and he's capable of purchasing the chametz. But if you're selling something to someone who really couldn't conceivably ever purchase this whole item, so then that also kind of calls into question, in the general sense, the seriousness of the transaction. But here there was an additional level that a lot of postmen were worried about, that what's the story if you're dealing with farmers? So the farmers, they own the land personally, and it's trickier than mechiras chametz, because when you're dealing with mechiras chametz, so you can worry also, does the person who's selling it really commit himself to the sale in a serious way? But at least that's his problem. Now, if he does or he doesn't, that's his problem, so you try to help him as much as you can. But here we're dealing with an economy in an agricultural society where it's going to affect others, so we already have a kind of an unusual situation where we have to worry about the seriousness of other people. It's not only a question of can you help somebody out to whatever extent possible. So are the farmers who are selling the land, if these farmers, let's say, they're not so religious, they're not so halachic, so if you tell them, don't worry, sell the land, it's fine, so is that really the case? Like, do they really commit to selling the land seriously if they don't really have any awareness or belief in the halachic underpinnings of what's going on? So this was an issue that a number of postmen were concerned about, and it exists on two tracks. One is simply the seriousness of the deal. Is it taken seriously by the people who are selling it? Do they think anything's really happening? Or do they think this is all just a joke? They're just signing on the bottom line, but they know it doesn't really mean anything. And if they thought it did mean something, maybe they'd object. That's part of what their concern is. And maybe they say, I don't want to sell my land to this Arab, and I wouldn't want that to really happen. So they say, no, don't worry, it's not really happening. It's just a religious thing. So is that okay? Is that really a sale then, if that's what you're saying to them? And what complicates it also is the consideration Dinat Malchus of Dinat. That should it bother us that the sale that's taking place is not a legally recognized sale in Israel. That in Israel there is a registry called the Tabu. It's a holdover from Turkish rule. That the Tabu is where all the land that's sold is registered. And if it's not registered in the Tabu, so then it's not considered to be a legal sale. So should we say that if you have land being sold in a way that's not going through the official legal process, so maybe that's a problem on two levels. One, maybe we should say dina de malchus dina, and therefore if the government doesn't recognize this transaction, so then it's not happening, the sale doesn't really take place. We're obligated to conduct business based on what is recognized by the civil authorities. And even if we could get around that question, so should we say that the very fact that it's not going through the same process that every other land transaction does, so then that means that it's not taken seriously. And the person selling it is not going to think that it's actually being sold. So this was another issue that postmen were very concerned about. You have these two tracks going together. And perhaps ironically, so we could separate the two considerations that in the 1970s they passed a law in the Knesset, a chok, it's called the chok of Mahashmita, something like that, that it was a law specifically designed to accommodate the Shemitah considerations. And it basically said that land that is sold through this Mechira mechanism is legally recognized even though it's not in the Tabu. So that may help the Dinat Malchus Adina question, but it may hurt the seriousness question. Maybe it just kind of emphasizes that this is just something that's being done for religious purposes, and therefore maybe the seller is not going to necessarily take it as something serious. This is a concern that's been addressed by Rav Weitman. Rav Weitman is the administrator of Shemitah issues, the chief rabbi, and is the rabbi of Tuna also. So he's written very extensively about these issues. And he's somebody who is taking great effort to try to balance the various considerations here. And on the one hand, it's his job to administer the Hetz Mechira. On the other hand, he's very sensitive to all the objections that have been raised, and also to the possibility that maybe nowadays the situation is different. So, that being the case, so he has worked to try to balance, you know, how could you make the sale serious without undermining it? And it's a tricky balance because, again, if you're dealing with non-religious farmers, so on the one hand, if you make it too overtly serious, so then they may not want to do it. They may not want to be comfortable with letting their land be sold out of their hands. On the other hand, if it's not serious, then it doesn't mean anything. So how do you navigate that balance? It's very tricky, and this is something that he's written extensively about. And it's an interesting question to what extent it has to matter. So, for example, if you say Dina de Malchus Dina is not in accordance with, let's consider before the Chok. So if you don't have Dina de Malchus Dina supporting this, is that a problem? So it gets into the whole question of what exactly Dina de Malchus Dina means in a halachic sense. Does it mean that one is not allowed to do things that the government prohibits, that the civil law prohibits? You have to observe the law. Or does it mean even more than that, that even if the government doesn't prohibit something, but if they don't recognize something, so we don't consider it recognized either? Because one could say, listen, it's not illegal to do this, it's simply not recognized. So is that a concern of Dina de Malchus or Dina of Herzog wrote about this? If there was in general, perhaps ironically, there is a view in Rishonim that Dina Malchus Adina doesn't apply in Eretz Yisrael, which happens to be a view that's not really brought in Shulchan Aruch, so it's not actually the view that necessarily has such an impact on Halacha Lamaisa. But Rav Herzog writes either way, he thinks that whatever your opinion of Dina Malchus Adina is in Eretz Yisrael, that presumably it does apply at least to regulated areas where it's undisputed. And therefore, that should be a consideration. That was something that he was worried about. Samuel, you raise your hand?
Yeah. To deal with the issue of the non-religious farmer issue.
Mm-hmm.
Why couldn't the Bay State institute some type of like mashkon or some type of security for the farmer? So they do a serious sale and say if it doesn't work out, which they know will,
mm-hmm.
they'll, you know, give you X amount of money that your field is worth so that the farmer then will comply.
You think that the government should take that prize for the very expensive
based
proposition?
In itself, I guess. But they know it's going to work out.
I mean, if they know that person is willing to give it back, you see,
yeah.
that they'll accept that prize. I still agree with your prize. Otherwise, they wouldn't get involved in the first place. I'm saying they should accept that prize. It'll be returned in its perfect shape, which is also a part of it. That's also part of what Revivum writes about. That, you know, theoretically, we'll have to get this a little more next week, but theoretically, the sale, you know, if it's going to be a sale and not, say, a rental, so a sale means that the purchaser can do with it what he wants. If he wants to build a cave inside the field, he should be able to do that as well. So how far do you go with this? You make that explicit that the purchaser can do that, and that really will convey it as a serious sale, like we do with the chametz. Right? With the chametz, we always want to make it clear that the purchaser, if he wants to, he can eat the chametz. He can take it, it's his. He'll have to pay for it afterwards, but he has the right to do that. So do we want to incorporate that explicitly here, or do we want to say that that's itself going to make the farmer more hesitant to get involved in the first place, and then we're going to have other issues? So I think what Revivum wrote is that since they put into the sharos that they're making it on Manas Lahatzah, that the individual should sell it back afterwards, so then that sale assumes that, doesn't have to say it explicitly, but it implies that you're going to keep it in the same condition that it was when you got it, otherwise it's not really giving it back. So that's a whole part of this tricky balance that gets incorporated into the whole story.
Hi. Isn't there a suggestion that the government should take on the position of a guarantor? Isn't that a problem also?
Some type of ownership.
Yeah,
that's an interesting question also, that theoretically there is some ownership that's ascribed to somebody who backs up. It's called achrayus. We find that with chametz also, that if you, it's a problem for your insurance company, if you back up the chametz, so then that also has a ownership status. And it's interesting to wonder if that would affect this question too, maybe that would affect this question. But it's interesting just to look at the comparison of the chametz. So there you find also that there is a whole discussion that what about the din of matus din? So, for example, in the Shuvas Minchas David, he has a discussion. I think the question is really better than the answer. I think the answer is not so satisfying. He says, when we sell chametz, so we have in our shtaros that we sell all the chametz, including all the liquors and medications that have chametz in them. So the truth is, that's a problem, because it's against the din of the malchusa to sell a liquor without a license, and it's against the din of the malchusa to sell medications without a license. So, and that would be a bigger problem. Maybe it's not just that the government doesn't recognize it, it's actually illegal, we could actually get in trouble for it. So he discusses there that since it's just done for religious purposes, so maybe the government doesn't have such a problem with it. So that may be true. I feel that that's a little inadequate, because in general, when it comes to Mecheres Chametz especially, so I think it's very important that we want to have an even greater recognition that it's a genuine sale, because we spoke about this like the last year Pesach time, maybe we'll speak about this year Pesach time also, but just the kids are, in order for Mecheres Chametz to work, it's especially important, as far as I understand it, not just that the sale should be valid, but it's crucial that the seller perceive it as valid, because the seller, in order to keep away from the issur of eating chametz, and how does he satisfy the Torah's requirement that he not own the chametz in the first place? So I think crucial for that whole process is his belief that the chametz is owned by someone else, and therefore it would be an issur of gezeila. It would be wrong for him to take from this chametz. So if the seller doesn't think it's a serious sale, so then in addition to how that may undermine the sale itself, but it also undermines the halachic accomplishment that we're going for. So we have to worry about that maybe more than when it comes to Shemitah. When it comes to Shemitah, if we're convinced the sale works, so then maybe you don't have to worry so much about whether or not the farmer actually has confidence in it. When it comes to the chametz, it seems like we have to have a greater consideration that it should work and that the seller should fully appreciate that it works. So I think any attitude with Mechiras Chametz as well, it's not real, it's only a religious thing, so they don't really care, that tends to undermine that attitude, and we have to be particularly careful about that. So when it comes to liquor and medicine for chametz, it's a good question, actually, why it should be okay to do that. I think it might be true that even if you take the religious component out of it, that when it comes to liquor, I could look into this, but I'm just speculating, that the reason you're not allowed to sell liquor without a license is they don't want you opening a bar or a liquor store without the government regulation. But let's say somebody had a bottle of wine that he received as a gift, and he drank half of it, and he doesn't like it anymore. So he wants to sell it to his neighbor. The neighbor's like, give me $25 for that half bottle of wine. So I would assume that if he would sell a liquor like that, the government's not going to care. They don't really have an objection to an individual-to-individual transfer of single units of liquor, as much as they object to a business that is dispensing liquor. So it might be true that that's not within the scope of the government's prohibition. I'm looking for that, but it might be true. When it comes to medication, it's not true. When it comes to medication, that's regulated because of the danger that's involved, and that day for sure it would be marketed if somebody would sell even one half package of pills to someone else without the license. I'm sure that would be an objection that the government has. So that's, I don't know a good answer to that, except that it may not be necessary to sell the medications in the first place. So if that part of our material companies doesn't work, so it's likely you don't have mitzvah by your other mitzvah there in the first place. So if it happens to be that that clause is not really effective, it's not necessarily the end of the world. That might be the very inadequate answer to that question. Is there a question about that?
Didn't we say that chametz is more serious?
In some ways it's more serious. Yeah, in some ways it's more serious, and in some ways the seriousness is more important. As we're seeing, there are a lot of...
technically, you can sell the medication or the alcohol, and they would say, oh, I want to keep it.
But we wouldn't
say the same thing about...
Right, wine. So the question is, so what does that mean legally? So legally, is that a problem? So the liquor, I would guess, and I'm not a lawyer, but I would guess that selling one bottle of liquor here and there to an individual level is not something the government really cares about. I think that they care about your opening a bar or a liquor store. The medicine, I think, is a bigger problem. I think that would be regulated by the government, but then maybe if the government, the medicine part doesn't work, maybe it's much more problem.
Can you make the claim that you're only selling part of medication that would have chametz in it?
Probably not. I can't imagine the government's going to care about that so much.
I mean, the government wouldn't care about that. So I can't
imagine the government's going to be okay with that. Try selling drugs like that. No, I only sold the medicinal part. I didn't sell the... try to open a marijuana store and say, I only sell the part of it that makes you feel better, not the high part.
Or I only sell the box.
Right. Yeah, I'm not going to go over well. So I can't really imagine that working. But in any event, so it's interesting to consider how these legal aspects impact on the validity of the sale, and is there a difference between Mechiras Chametz and Mechiras Karkos in this sense. So in any event, this was a major issue, and recent developments in terms of the Hakamas HaMedin in the middle of the whole past century, and the law changing to incorporate Shemitah, all of them have either subtle or maybe major impacts on how some of these shilas are going to play out. So that brings us to perhaps the biggest issue, which we haven't got up to yet, the elephant in the room, which I guess we'll discuss next week, the question of, separate from the issue of does it work, is the sale serious or not, but is there perhaps a significant total prohibition that is being violated by the sale itself? If so, that would be the biggest difference between this and Mechiras Chametz, and the biggest reason to accept Mechiras Chametz and not to accept Het Mechira might be because of that, so that we'll have to pick up with next week. So just to quickly chazer what we spoke about today. So we discussed how the Derabbanan question factors into the central issue of Yesh Kenyan Lahavkiya, spoke about that Machlokis that appears in a couple places in Shas, about Yesh Kenyan or Ein Kenyan. We discussed about how the Gemara makes a distinction between Surya and other areas, and about whether that's a Kibush Yachid, Derabbanan factor. and about how halacha maisa, how that machlokas comes out, and how the drabban status, which could be because of Shemitah itself, or could be more broadly because of Kedushas Eretz Yisrael, affects the question of Yesh Kenyan Lahavkiyah, the machlokas between the Beis Yosef and the Ma'abit and the Ma'arit, and how that the machlokas doesn't necessarily take you to Het Mechira, but could theoretically, about the question of why was there a distinction the Poskim made that Melachos Daraisa should not be done by Jews, even with the context of Mechira, and whether or not that's been upheld, and how that factors into the whole machlokas, and the question of Gemiras Das and seriousness, some of the issues we raised last week in a general sense, and a little bit more specific sense here about the credibility of one purchaser buying the whole land, but also more specifically, what about any variance between the attitudes of the sellers specifically and the belief in this genuine sale, and how the Dina de Malchus Adina affects that. Is that itself a problem, Dina Malchus Adina, or is it a problem that it affects the seriousness? And you could split the issue by noting that there was eventually a law passed that recognizes it legally, but then maybe kind of strengthens the sense that it's not really serious. And then we drew some comparisons to Mechiras Chametz, where you have some comparable issues. Maybe there's a difference in how those issues should affect things, maybe there isn't. And we consider that issue, and that all gets us to the major question of a possible issue that's involved, which, God willing, we will pick up with next week. All right, I wish everyone a wonderful day. Should be only good things. Tomorrow we'll continue with issues of some